You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Anthony Hopkins made his film debut in 1968, playing Richard I in The Lion in Winter. He's gone on to portray many memorable characters, including C.S. Lewis and John Quincy Adams, plus some of history's more troubled figures like Pablo Picasso and Richard Nixon, and real monsters, Titus Andronicus and Dr. Hannibal Lecter. In his latest film, however, he plays a writer. And in real life, he wrote the script, directed, and composed the music for the film, which is called Slipstream. It features an impressive ensemble cast that includes Christian Slater, John Turturro, Cameron Manheim, Jeffrey Tambor, and S. Apather Murchison, and it opens at the MC25 today. I'm very pleased that it has brought Anthony Hopkins to my show. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You've already directed a film, August, but that was based on Uncle Vanya. Obviously, you couldn't have written that script.
No, it was adapted for a Welsh screenplay by Julian Mitchell, and somebody said, would you like to direct it? I said, yeah, okay, and they wanted me to play a part in it. And I wasn't too happy with the director who was assigned, so I politely said, well, I'd like to direct it. There were a couple of raised eyebrows, but anyway, it was a bit of a rush, so one take, two takes, and I let the editor get on with it. It was okay. I wrote the music for that as well, so that was my first pride and joy.
Now, you wrote the music for this one, and I wondered about that. Did you study music before you got into acting?
Yes, not in a formal way. I started as a kid at 6 years of age, and I fiddled around on the piano just making music as the years went by, but I never took it seriously. And then recently I finished this movie, and I always dabbled in composing music, and somebody said you should write the music, so I said, okay. I didn't want to do it as an ego trip, but they said, well, why not? You could do it. So I did. And I improvised as the film was running, you know, and with an orchestral. And then I conducted the orchestra over at NBC. So there you are.
And it's interesting how many directors have composed music for themselves. Charlie Chaplin, of course, yeah. Satyajit Ray. Clint Eastwood is now composing music for his films.
Yes, and I think Clint is doing some music for another film as well, so somebody else's movie.
Well, maybe you can write a script for somebody else's film.
Yeah.
Is this the first original script you've written?
Yes, it is a really original script because I wanted to break all the rules. And it starts off as they say, non-linear, whatever that means. But anyway, it doesn't have a beginning, middle, or end. It starts off at the end, a hint of a tremendous impact, a crisis in a man's life, a screenplay writer, which I play. My part isn't a big part. It's really an observer. So it was very easy for me to be in it and direct it. But anyway, a lot of the actors, when they came on board, they said, what's it about? I said, well, I know what it's about, but I don't want to really explain because it's sort of impossible. I said it's a feel for it. And Christian Slater was one of the first guys who got the idea, and then John Turturro and Clark Duncan.
The film is about making a film and the fuzzy line between reality and invented reality.
Yes.
Is this something that occurred to you during one of the long waits between takes on a film shoot?
No, I tell you what it was. It was about 4 years ago, and I started having a look back over my life. I had a lot of time to contemplate the dolphins in the sea at Malibu or my navel, whichever. My wife said to me, why don't you write a script? I said, yeah, okay. And I started from page one and I just let it go. I'm not a writer by profession. I didn't have any concerns whether it was good or bad. I did it as an experiment, an exercise, a mental exercise, really. And when I finished it, I read it back. I thought, well, this is interesting. It doesn't make sense to me. But I simply wanted to break all the rules of film directing and knock it on its head a little, you know, mess with time and space.
Well, there are also everything that can go wrong in making a film happens in the making of this film, and I suspect that was inspired by any number of experiences on sets that you've had over the years.
Oh, yes. I can't remember the details of things I've experienced when somebody is ill and is replaced and the producer comes on, shouts and screams at everyone. And I've witnessed that, and it's pretty unpleasant. And
here you have an overwhelmed director, whiny actors complaining about having some of their best moments cut out.
And Michael Clark Duncan, yeah. It was, in a way, as I was writing the script, I always toyed with the idea. I've always been fascinated by the difference of the reality and unreality of movies and why we do it and why actors act. And I thought one day I'll write a movie about a movie, but in the movie, halfway through that scene, they say cut because the actor collapses. The actor collapses because he dies from overacting, which is Christian Slater's great performance. And I just wanted to have a light-hearted jab in the ribs at the actors, saying, come on, don't take yourself so seriously.
But that's part of the fun of it. When I was watching Christian Slater overact, I thought, gee, he is really chewing up this scenery, and then suddenly that is part of the plot. I mean, he was doing it on purpose. It must also be fun for an actor to be able to play somebody who's overdoing it.
Christian had a ball. When I phoned him up, he was in London. I said, would you like to read the script he read? And I said, would you do it? He said, yeah, man, it's a trip. I said, okay, well, you just have some fun with it. And he came in that day in the diner scene, and he just took it. He took the set over. He just ran through it like a train. It was terrific.
Well, we should point out that what happens is the film seems to be about a certain story, and then later we realize that this is really the film that's being made.
Yeah.
And often actors play two or three different parts in the film. There's much of it is really also going on in the head of the character you play, Felix Bonhoeffer.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the whole thing is a dream within a dream within a dream. And I quote at the beginning something from Edgar Allan Poe about the nature of life, that it's all a dream within a dream. And at the end, it's about an obsessive writer who has a breakdown himself, ends up in hospital, and finally the disastrous end of the movie is something. And then there's the surprise end that it's all an illusion anyway, and that's my philosophy of life.
Did you find it easy to make the jump from actor to director?
Oh, yeah, quite easy. There's no big deal in directing. I don't think maybe a director would jump down my throat for saying that, but I think you let the actors do what they can do, and I'd sit there and I'd make a few suggestions and I'd point the camera and say, well, go with it, and they would.
Well, I've always wondered whether actors who become directors are also doing all the stuff they wished other directors had done, because I'm sure you've worked with some pretty terrific ones, but others who you thought, if I ever direct, I'm never going to be like this.
Oh, yes. I've been with the directors who do 50 takes.
And are very controlling and tell you, Anthony Hopkins, how to deliver a line.
Oh, I've had directors control every eye. And I thought, when I do this, I'd love to do something different and not do so many takes and treat everyone with courtesy and respect.
You also, as we said, play a part in the film. Did you ever feel like you were being pulled in lots of different directions, director, actor?
No
writer worrying about whether your script is being well served?
Well, I said to people, there were scenes that were very complicated, and I said to John Turturro and Christian, I said, just go with it and improvise around it as well. And I had a Steadicam and all that, freewheeling, and I just let people do what they felt right in their characters, and they did so well. Cameron Manheim was one in case, but John Turturro, wonderful performances they were, and Michael Clarke Duncan gave a blazing performance, a very funny performance. So I just let the actors have a ball with it, and I didn't get in their way.
My guest is Anthony Hopkins, who has written, directed, and composed the music for a film called Slipstream, which opens today at the AMC 25. Where does the title Slipstream come from?
Well, I'd originally called the script Bonhoeffer, because that's the name of the character I played, and I realized...
Well, there's a famous
Dietrich
German...
Bonhoeffer, yeah. And that came arbitrarily. That came into my mind. It's quite random. Slipstream? I think when somebody meets a crisis in their life, there's a displacement of spiritual energy of some kind. And, you know, with a fast vehicle, as the vehicle, the car figures a lot in this film. It's the motor vehicle, which really figures so much in the film as a destructive force and power. And I was down in Santa Monica looking for locations, and these great trucks would come by. My car would shake, and I thought, that's a good thing, Slipstream.
Now, why make this film in the United States? Are you pretty much an American these days, living here? You teach at UCLA, don't you?
I used to, and I've got a doctorate actually to go back and teach. I've lived in California many years, and so I've become an American. I've got a funny accent, I know, but I'm an American by nature, I think.
If you're one of those rare British actors who doesn't do the American accent in most of the roles, right now it's hard to tell who's an American and who's a Brit, because people have become incredibly adept.
Yeah, I noticed that. Ray Winston is one who was in The Departed, and a lot of actors like Tim Roth and Bob Hoskins, they do perfect American accents. I'm not that good with them. I just, you know, I'd rather stay with my own. I mean, I wish I could, but it's a great skill, that is.
There, one of the things that seems to cause some actors who become directors difficulties is the visual sides of the direction. But this film is quite visually sophisticated. Is that something that you had just picked up along the way?
Well, I asked a great cinematographer, Dante Spinotti, would you be interested in doing the movies? Yeah, I'd love to do it. So I gave him the full range of whatever he could do, and he was a master of photography, so I left it with him.
The film often uses the convention of freezing for a second as if a still camera has taken a picture. Are you saying that life is sometimes a series of snapshots?
To me, it has been. Most of my life I've had dramatic insights into the things. I don't know where that comes from. And almost illusory vision of life. Maybe it was the old tequila days that did it for me. But I've experienced life in that way. I've seen things which are really disturbing and amusing as well. And I use that as a convention to disturb the audience, to poke them in the head and say, come on, you know, this is just a movie. And I use all the tricks in the book and break all the rules just to reverse time and space on people.
You also include shots from other movies and history throughout the film. Did you include footage of Nixon as a kind of an inside joke? After all, you did play the man yourself, and you have Christian Slater doing a Nixon imitation at one time.
Yeah. Well, when I came to America in 74, exactly 43 years ago, 33 years ago, Watergate had just finished. So it was a crossroads in my life when I came to New York. So that wasn't meant to be something of a tribute to my own Nixon. And the Hitler and that other thing was, because that was part of my life as well. I remember the war and I remember the end of it and the American soldiers in Britain. So that was all part of my life. And when the Nixon shot occurs over that freeway shootout and somebody said, welcome to America. So when I first came to Los Angeles, I saw a shootout on the freeway and it was pretty alarming. And somebody said, this is the United States. So it was a...
In those days, very few people in Britain had guns. There are a lot more guns around these days.
There are. The licensing laws in England are pretty tough, though. You can't get a gun like that like you can in this country.
A film like this, which is an independent film and works on a rather tight budget, usually doesn't have a cast of this sort. Did you have specific actors in mind for the roles?
Yeah, Christian Slater, Michael Clark Duncan, and John Turturro, I had him in mind, but I wasn't sure if he'd be available. But I did phone him, and he said he would try and make himself available. He had some window in his work, so I waited for him, and we fitted in, and I was so pleased to get him.
Had you worked with them before?
No, I'd only met him once before. Cameron Mannheim wanted her for that part, and the Peyton Murkison and I. So it was all pretty good, you know, the way they came in and did it.
Is it true that you discovered one of your actresses in a coffee shop in L.A.?
Yes, Jennifer Mann. She was she plays the waitress in the diner. My wife and I were in the valley, in San Fernando Valley, and we stopped at this bakery coffee shop, and this young woman served us. She's a pretty girl, a pretty young woman, and Stella said she'd be good, you know. She was an actress, you know, lots of waiters out there are actors. So we took her name and she's in the movie.
This is the Lana Turner story updated.
Yeah.
And you've cast your wife in the film. Now, she'd never acted before, had she?
She had a small part in Dallas with Larry Hagman many years ago. So I wrote this part, and I said, would you like to be in a movie? She said, no. I said, well, do you want to read it? She read it. I said, well, I don't know. I said, well, if you want it, it's there. So she said, yes, I'll have a go at it. She said, but get rid of me if I'm not good enough. So we'll see about that. And the first day filming, she was nervous. So I left her alone as much as I could. And she was with Bill Lucking, who plays the detective. And at the end of the day, I said, that was good. What's your problem? You know, you're fine.
Well, she plays the wife of the screenwriter. That's you. To some degree, it's typecasting. But I guess this is one of those things where you said, act naturally, and she did.
That's right. When she improvises lines, she eats your salads. It's organic. And my wife says those things, but eat it. It's organic. And I laugh at her. I assume it's organic. She says, it's organic. She's always concerned about my diet and the way I eat.
One of the actors is Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah.
And he's playing himself. You even have little clips and a lot of talk about Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I don't know if Don Siegel was a favorite director of yours. Well, this is the original Body Snatchers. There have been two remakes, and as far as I'm concerned, the original one, the one that Don Siegel did with Kevin McCarthy, is by far the best.
Oh, it's a wonderful movie. I saw that when I was a much younger man. I saw it in 1958, 57, when it had been done 55. I came to Britain by that time, and I thought it was a great movie.
With the gorgeous Dana Winters.
Dana Winters, and Don Siegel did a few Clint Eastwood movies as well. And I like that kind of director, and I know Eastwood likes that kind of director. They were close friends. But Kevin I'd known here in New York 30-odd years ago, so I know he's 94 now, so I wrote him.
He's 94? Yeah. He does not look it.
No, he's an extraordinary man. So I wrote him a letter. I said, I don't know where you're living. He phoned me back. He was living in the valley, and he said, Tony, I want to do the part. So he came over. I fed him a bottle of Dom Pérignon champagne, and he said, why don't we go? And made sure he was okay. He was the first one I filmed in the desert earlier on because it's pretty hot up there, and I wanted to make sure he was absolutely okay. He's a little shaky, I know, when he stands, because he's a very old man and a wonderful, wonderful man, a great storyteller.
My guest is Anthony Hopkins, who has written, directed, and composed the music for a new film called Slipstream, which opens today at the AMC 25. I assume you probably did a few other things that you didn't take credit for. I mean, after all, you've done so much of... I forgot to say you also appear in this film. And you mentioned the desert. Much of the film takes place in the Mojave Desert. It doesn't get really hot in the Mojave Desert in daytime?
It gets up to 110. 110. So I remember the first day I said to the whole crew, I said, look, you watch out for the rattlesnakes. There are lots of those around. Scorpions and all that. Take it easy, drink plenty of water, and just don't rush. Don't try and make this film a big deal. And that was relaxing for everyone. And we came in on schedule because they took their time, but they were so efficient and the best movie crew I could have worked with.
Well, when you're working on a tight budget, do you have to find inventive ways to keeping costs down? You were working on a set that was already there in the Mojave, weren't you?
That set had been built, I think, by Dennis Hopper. He'd paid for it for a commercial, I believe. That's what I was told, anyway. But we would cut corners because we had a good AD and production manager who knew the locations we could get to efficiently and back, rain cover and all that sort of thing. So it was all pretty centralized. Whenever we moved anywhere, we were a stone's throw from one location to the next. And it got more awkward in Los Angeles because of the distances we had to travel. But we did it okay, and I was very good about keeping the costs under. We went digital and high definition, so there wasn't much time wasting of changing magazines for the film and all that. And we had a superb cinematographer. So I wasted no time at all.
Well, that is something that certain actor-directors have also done. I guess it's because, like Clint Eastwood, who's always amused that that some films are so expensive because of egomaniacal directors. He said once that some budgets he could invade a small island.
Yeah.
I'm sure that there were times when you just were sitting in some trailer thinking, when is this director going to get going on this?
Oh, I've been in several of those. Some of them are like nightmares because you never go anywhere. Nothing happens. You sometimes stand around for days. I don't mind if they want to pay me, but I get itchy because the waste of money. I mean, where's this money going? You could build a hospital or a school for that.
Do you think that now that people will see this film that the industry will get a new idea of what Anthony Hopkins is all about?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't really set it up with an end in mind. I don't know. I mean, I did it as an experiment, and if they like it, fine. And I don't think it's going to revolutionize anything.
But you're an auteur now because you've written and directed the film.
Yeah, is that what it's called, an auteur? Oh,
yes. Yes.
American dictionary, this word game.
Well, auteur, I think the French gave it to the directors who they felt were authors of their own film.
Oh, is that what it meant? Oh, yeah, I guess I'm that. Yeah.
Do you see yourself writing and directing more? Or do you ever see yourself giving up acting?
No. I would like to do one more film, maybe write another one. I've started writing one, in fact. But I don't set it with a burning, razor-sharp focus of ambition for it. I mean, if it happens, it happens. I'm pretty diffused in my ambitions now. I've been around a long time.
Well, you've taken longer to direct your first film than most actor-directors.
Yes.
Most of them start pushing for it when they're in their late 20s, early 30s.
Well, that's the last thing I want to do is push, because I'm too lazy to push. I'd rather be laid back and detached and see what comes up the pipeline.
Is that why you're comfortable in Los Angeles, where everybody's laid back except when they're on the freeway and then they tailgate you at 90 miles an hour?
I live out in Malibu, so you can't get you can't get up. You can remain cool out there.
You don't like to be called Sir Anthony Hopkins. Is that because you live in this country, or just because that kind of thing doesn't really fit you well?
No, it's not that. It's
Well, sir, I mean, Laurence Olivier used to joke and say, call me Sir Larry.
Yeah, but he was pretty relaxed about it. And I think most of these guys have been knighted. They're pretty relaxed about it. And I don't. It's unnecessary. And sometimes Americans get it wrong. They say, Sir Hopkins. And I say, no, forget it. And at the hotels and restaurants. But no, I'd rather be relaxed. But it's a great honor to have it. But I want to be easy with it.
I mentioned that over the course of your career, you played a fair number of monsters. Do you like those roles?
They were okay. I mean, Hannibal Lecter was...
it did very well for you.
It did. It did. And I played one recently, a guy who kills his wife. It was a film called Fracture. They're sort of, it was fun. But they're charismatic parts to play because they dare things that other human beings don't do, whether they're monstrous things. But nevertheless, I think they are in a dark way is sort of attractive to people, to audiences, because they dare to walk the line. And I'll only do a script if it's really good and it's got a good director. So,
well, part of the success of your portrayals of those monsters is you often make them quite charming.
Well, I think the trick is to not play them evil and just to play them quite normal. And then you let the audience knows, and the audience makes up its mind. But if you play it quite normal, the audience will read into it. You don't have to act it out. And it can apply to anything. You don't have to act up a storm. Let the audience do the work for you.
Well, Alfred Hitchcock once said, it's scarier to have a murder in a sunny kitchen than in a dark alley.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And your approach to those parts is definitely sunny kitchen, which makes a character like Hannibal Lecter really scary.
Yeah, because that's what fear is. I mean, meet someone on the street in bright daylight, and it doesn't have to be dark and gloomy. I mean, the man in my film is shot in the middle of a desert in daylight, bright sunshine, and frightening things start happening. But you can apply that to any part, really. Is to keep it as low key as possible and let the audience do the work.
Anthony Hopkins Slipstream, written, directed, music composed by Anthony Hopkins, also starring Anthony Hopkins, Christian Slater, John Turturro, Cameron Manheim, Jeffrey Tambor, S. Apatha Murchison, and others, opens at the AMC 25 today. It has been my great pleasure to talk to the man of all seasons on the show today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.